Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's census call. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you will have the opportunity to ask questions during the question-and-answer session, and you may register to ask a question at any time by pressing the star and one on your touch-tone phone. Please note this call is being recorded. It is now my pleasure to turn today's program over to Coreli Hernandez with the Leadership Conference, Civil and Human Rights. Please go ahead.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining this call. My name is Coreli Hernandez with the Leadership Conference on Civil and Human Rights, the nation's premier civil and human rights coalition of more than 200 national organizations working to build an America as good as its ideals. The 2020 census will be in full swing in less than 2 years, which means this is a critical period on the path toward a fair and accurate census. The census is an attempt to count every person in the United States every 10 years and is required by the U.S. Constitution. Getting it right is important to everyone. The data gathered in the 2020 census will be used to allocate congressional seats and electoral college votes among the states and to draw lines for congressional, state, and local voting districts, to allocate more than $800 billion annually in federal funding, and to implement and enforce civil rights laws. Joining me today to discuss the nuts and bolts of the 2020 census, such as key milestones, ways to measure census accuracy, and major operational and field infrastructure preparations for 2018 and 2019 are Terrianne Lowenthal, former staff director of the House Census and Population Subcommittee and policy advisor to the Leadership Conference Education Fund, and Dr. Joseph Salvo, head of the Population Diversity Division at the New York City Department of City Planning. First, we will hear from Terrianne Lowenthal. Go ahead, Terrianne.
Thank you, Coreli, and hello, census reporters. I really appreciate, want to thank the Leadership Conference for hosting what I think is an important briefing. You know, Joe Salvo and I have been through more than a few censuses together over the years, and I think we both agree that the press plays really important role in helping to educate the public about the importance of the census, you know, and also about challenges. So we're going to start with just a brief overview. I'm going to call it a lightning round, and here we go. I'm going to start with an overarching point. The census does not start on April 1st, 2020. That is a reference date only. It is set in law and informally called Census Day. The Census Bureau counts the residents of the country and where they usually live as of that date. And so in a minute, I'll give you the Cliff Notes version of the counting timeline. But first, I'm going to turn it over to Joe, who will give you the Sparks Notes version of the first major field activities. All of these are associated with ensuring an accurate framework for the census through the master address list and the associated digital map. So, Joe, over to you.
Thank you, Terrianne. In 1994, Congress passed a law that created a program called the Local Update of Census Addresses, or LUCA. It's the Address List Improvement Act created this program. It's a program where state, local, and tribal governments participate voluntarily. And the basic process has not changed, really, since that point. Participating governments get their address list this time around between February and April of this year. And then the information that they're getting consists of what we call exact addresses. That is number, street name, and apartment number. Literally every single address for every housing unit in a jurisdiction. And we have 120 days to review that list and report additions to the list, deletions to the list, and corrections to the Census Bureau. Examples might be a one-family house that has an additional unit in it where we would add that unit to the list. Another example would be a housing unit that's in the wrong geographic location. We correct the geographic location of that residence. The Census Bureau then checks the submission and provides feedback to the state or locality in the summer of 2019. Localities will have a chance to appeal any rejected addresses to an independent arbiter. but the Bureau is likely to accept most new addresses and let census takers follow up during the count if no one at the address returns a census form. So in the fall of 2019, the Bureau has a program for including new housing units that is follows the LUCA period, where we can submit data on new construction. In other words, the LUCA period runs through June or July the following year in 19. July or the summer of 19, we get their feedback. And then there are housing units that get built subsequent to that whole LUCA operation. And those housing units need to be included. This program that includes them is called New Construction, the New Construction Program, and it follows in the fall of 2019. This is the first census where 70% of the nation's addresses will be checked in office, a major milestone for the Census Bureau, and testimony to advances in such technologies as aerial imagery. Not all addresses can be checked in office, however. Census workers need to hit the pavement, what we call the in-field canvassing, in places where the housing stock is changing, growing or shrinking, for example, or where other data sources, including aerial imagery and commercial databases, can't confirm these changes, such as in small multi-unit buildings or conversions from office to residential use. The Census Bureau estimates that about 30% of the nation's more than 140 million housing units will fall into this category and need to be checked in the field. In late 2018, the Census Bureau will begin recruiting staff for some 40 area census offices, or what we call ACOs. We'll be hiring managers, clerical staff, and field supervisors, followed by the field workers who will check addresses. This is the first major hiring effort for the 2020 census. So now I'm going to turn it back to Terry Ann to talk about the enumeration timeline and how we are how we can mark the progress of the census going forward.
Great. Thanks, Joe. So two additional major areas to cover here. As Joe said, the first, when does the count actually start and when does it end? So the enumeration starts in remote Alaskan villages in late January of 2020. The first large operation for the census is called self-response, and that's when households can complete the census online for the first time, by telephone for the first time, or mail back a paper form, and no one will come to the door to visit them, even if they don't answer all of the questions. Now, most of the self-response phase starts in mid-March of 2020, and about 80% of homes will get a letter inviting them to respond online or by telephone with a unique code. About 20% of homes also will get a paper form in that first mailing, although they too can go online or call. And for the first time, mailings will go out in three waves spanning about a week in an effort to reduce the likelihood that the IT system for the first high-tech online census will crash. Now, by mid-April, so we go past Census Day, April 1st, and by mid-April, all homes in the mailing universe that didn't yet self-respond will get a reminder letter and a paper questionnaire. Now, meanwhile, census workers will deliver packets of materials to about 12 million addresses in rural and remote areas and on American Indian reservations. Happy to go into detail later, but these work census takers verify and update the address list as they go because of non-traditional addressing schemes. And then also in March of 2020, the Bureau starts counting group facilities such as college dorms, prisons, and the like. Now, the second large operation is the door-knocking phase, right? That's called non-response follow-up. Generally, that will start on May 13th of 2020, and it will run through July. There is one exception. In areas with lots of off-campus college students, the door-knocking phase will start earlier in April. Now, I'm going to save most of the detail about how census workers conduct the follow-up visits for question and answer. If you have any, two quick points to highlight. For the first time, The Census Bureau will use administrative data, especially from the Postal Service, to identify unresponsive homes that are in fact vacant or maybe not even a valid address. And they will take those addresses out of the universe that census workers will visit. And second, census workers will visit all occupied households that didn't self-respond at least once. All right. Now, finally, let me just talk quickly about how you know, how you will know as reporters, how well the census is going. During the self-response phase, the Census Bureau will measure the progress in terms of the percent of homes, percent of addresses that answer the census. Remember, the Bureau doesn't yet know if an unresponsive home is vacant or occupied. And so the self-response rate is the percent of all homes, not the percent of people, not even the percent of households, if you want to be technical about it, that answered the census by internet, phone, or paper questionnaire. And the Bureau will likely report those self-response rates on a weekly basis for states, localities, even down to what's called the census tract level. And then after the self-response phase, the Bureau will determine, after it makes the determination I described earlier about vacancy status, it'll then report final percents of occupied housing units, now you can call them households, that responded voluntarily. The Bureau last time around called that the participation rate. It believes that's the truest measure of public cooperation, but I don't like the term participation rate because it kind of sounds like that's the number of people or homes that participated in the census, and that's not really true. And then finally, during the door-knocking phase, the Bureau will continue to report the cumulative percentage of households that have been counted by one means or another until the enumeration in every area has reached 100% of all addresses and, of course, the group facilities in the census universe. So I will retire a happy consultant if everyone reports on the progress of the census operations in terms of households or homes instead of people counted. So that's how you monitor the progress of the census in real time. And Joe's going to wrap up by talking about how the Bureau measures the accuracy of the census when all is said and done.
Thanks, Terri-Ann. After the door-knocking phase of the census is complete, the Census Bureau draws what we call a representative sample of blocks from across the country. They draw this sample from the address list, and households in those blocks are visited again to determine whether they were enumerated and whether they were enumerated correctly in the census. This is called a post-enumeration survey, or PES. Estimates of persons missed, which we frequently refer to as omissions, are compared with those who were counted more than once. And yes, there are people who are counted multiple times. We call those duplications. There are people who may have been counted incorrectly, as in the wrong place. We call those erroneous enumerations. We put all of this together, and what we get is an estimate of net undercount or net overcount by a small number of demographic characteristics, including age, race, Hispanic origin, gender, whether your home is owned or rented, and frequently owner and renter is used as a proxy for higher or lower income population. The net undercount for the nation in 2010 was essentially zero. There was actually a small net overcount, but essentially it was zero, meaning that the omissions and the duplications offset each other. But accuracy, and this is the key point, accuracy differs by group, by geographic area. You can have an overall situation where undercount is net zero, but specific groups, for example, African Americans, have a disproportionately high undercounts. In the 2010 census, the African American population was undercounted by 2.1%, the Hispanic population by 1.5%, renters 1.1%, and females 50 and over were actually overcounted by 2.4%. And then using a variety of estimates, young children have been shown to be undercounted. Depending upon the methodology that is used, and we can get into this later if you want, that undercount could be as much as 5%. So in New York City, let me say, for my my hometown, for example, the 2010 net undercount was essentially zero, but we know that young children, African Americans, and parts of Queens, specifically northwestern Queens, and the southern tier of Brooklyn were undercounted, while non-Hispanic whites and homeowners were more likely to be overcounted. So that's kind of the synopsis of the undercount and accuracy evaluation that takes place after the census is complete. So I'm going to turn it back over to our moderator so that we can maybe take some questions.
Thank you, Joseph. We're now ready to take questions from reporters. Priscilla, can you please provide instructions for asking questions?
Certainly. At this time, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star and one on your touchtone telephone. You may withdraw your question at any time by pressing the pound key. Once again, to ask a question, please press the star and one on your touchtone phone. And we'll take our first question from Charles Hallman with the Minnesota Spokesman. Your line is open.
Yes, you gave us a lot of information, and it's really going to be helpful to try to bear that down. But if I write for an African American publication, so if you can just give us a real clear conception why this is important, because the image is that the census, blacks will not be counted like they always been counted, and two, what is your concern about funding of all these things that need to be done? Will that be affected by Congress, and how that will affect the county?
So,
well, Joe, why don't you go ahead and I'll add on.
Okay. I can speak certainly for New York City on this count. If you take a look at New York City's neighborhoods, you will see that the most undercounted, historically in New York City, most undercounted population essentially is African American. And the African American neighborhoods generally have not done well in the census enumeration. And I want to point out that that spans the economic spectrum. In Southeast Queens, we have among the wealthiest African American households in the nation, yet undercount is still substantial in that group. And it concerns us a great deal. We are taking steps to try to reach out to the African American community. We have done this in the past and we'll continue to do so. But the thing that concerns us the most is the underrepresentation politically and from the standpoint of funding that does not go to communities of the city that need the help frequently the most. And certainly there are communities in Brooklyn and in the Bronx, for example, and in Manhattan that could stand more funding for things like community centers, for Title I, for children with disabilities and children in poor neighborhoods. And frequently these are black neighborhoods of the city, and we need to adopt, I think, a stronger message about the fact that if you don't answer the census or you're not included in the census, that you indeed are shortchanged in a major way. So, Terri-Ann, do you want to?
I think that was that hit all the important points. I would just add, since our friend from Minnesota asked about funding for the census, I mean, Joe is absolutely correct that since the Census Bureau has been measuring scientifically the accuracy of the count, we know that the black community, particularly black men, have had disproportionately high rates of undercounting. Now, the Census Bureau has been able to improve the count, the accuracy of the count, for all population groups over time. But it's the difference, the gap, if you will, between the accuracy of the count for, let's say, the black population or black men of working age, And the what is now an overcount of non-Hispanic whites, it's that difference that really has consequences, as Joe said, for the distribution or the fair and correct distribution of political representation all the way from Congress all the way down to city councils and school boards, as well as the allocation of really vital federal program dollars and state resources and business investment. I think that one of the keys to overcoming this historic disproportionate undercount is to have trusted messengers and trusted voices at the very local level, reaching out to communities to talk about why it is important and why it's safe to participate in the census. And in order to do that, I mean, the census really, when all is said and done, is a people activity. And that's going to take some resources, some money. And it is up to Congress and the administration together to make sure the Census Bureau has enough money to do that outreach, to do targeted advertising, to have a really robust partnership program with state and local groups and trusted voices, and to have a big presence in the field. And so I think stakeholders definitely are urging Congress and urging the administration to allocate even more than this administration has requested.
Thank you, Tarianne. Priscilla, we're ready for the next question.
Certainly. We'll go next to Hansi Wang with NPR. Your line is open.
Thank you. This question is for Tarianne. Just Tarianne, you said there's a distinction between, when thinking about the participation rate, the distinction between homes and households, if we wanted to get technical about it. What is that distinction?
No, I'm glad you asked. So I was trying to put on a reporter's hat. So a household is an occupied housing unit. And so, of course, we don't know which addresses, if you will, which living quarters are occupied until the whole first phase, the self-response phase of the census, is finished. So technically, during self-response, it's not even correct to say 50% of households have responded. You know, because we don't know, the Census Bureau doesn't know that yet. So I throw out the word homes as a word that maybe reporters will find a little less technical than saying 50% of addresses or 50% of housing units or 50% of addresses on the Census Bureau's list. I was just trying to offer, another word that the press might use so that readers would understand it. But again, it's not until we get to that door-knocking phase that the Census Bureau will then look at the Postal Service information about vacant homes or perhaps addresses that aren't really a home. Maybe it was converted to a business. Maybe it's been burned out or torn down and is non-existent. We won't know until then which of the remaining addresses are occupied. Then you can start to call them households.
I see.
I hope that helps.
Thank you. We'll move next to Joanne Fields with the Filipino Press. Your line is open.
Good morning. My question pertains to the statement that there's a need for trusted voices in the community to work with and deliver the messaging of the importance of the census. Earlier on the call, there was a report of the hiring of certain positions within the census. I didn't hear any mention of the partnership specialist program. Has that been eliminated, or is Congress still trying to work on a budget for that? And to piggyback on that question, I'd like to draw attention to the Native Hawaiian and Pacific Islander community. Has the Filipino community moved from Asian to Pacific Islander? And has the Guamanian category been replaced with Chamorro?
Joe, why don't I start quickly and then turn it over to you for sort of the on-the-ground perspective, first about the partnership program. So the Census Bureau's partnership program for 2020 has started. Right now, there are only 43 partnership specialists on staff nationwide. Fortunately, Congress allocated more money for 2018 to ramp up that number. The Bureau is in the process of hiring 70 more partnership specialists right now. But stakeholders have made it clear they think that number needs to be much higher. The Census Bureau plans to have 1,000 partnership specialists on board for peak operations, which will be calendar years and or fiscal years 2019 and 2020. Again, stakeholders are recommending that Congress allocate more funds to double the number of partnership staff from 1,000 to 2,000. Now, some of those could be partnership specialists or partnership assistants. That's the sort of determination the Census Bureau should make, you know, and have the flexibility to determine. But that is moving forward, and the Bureau is now hiring more partnership staff slowly but surely across the country. The other had to do with the rate. You asked about the race question. So Filipinos are still considered under the Asian American category. But just remember, it is not the Census Bureau that sets the definitions for the collection, the federal collection of data on race and ethnicity. It is the Office of Management and Budget. Now, the Census Bureau designs the race question and the ethnicity, the Hispanic origin question for the census within those parameters. But so far for the 2020 census, one of the subgroups on the form under the Native Hawaiian and Pacific Islander category, which is separate from Asian American, is Guamanian. But, you know, somebody could write in Chamorro if that is how they identify.
Thank you for that, because I did work on the census in 2000, decennial in 2000 and 2010 as a partnership specialist, and that's the buzz going around with the former staff and other media outlets. And then lastly, California Governor Brown, he sent out a press release with his 25 appointments to the California Complete Count Committee. Is there coordination with this national media group or any other entity that we should know about?
Joe, why don't you jump in on sort of what's going on the ground with complete count committees and the like? I mean, we can't comment specifically on California. We're aware of that, and they'll be sort of doing their own thing in California. But Joe, let me turn it over to you.
Yeah. This time around, obviously, the Census Bureau is getting a bit of a late start from the standpoint of budget, and as Terry Ann indicated, they're going to be ramping up their partnership campaign, and we have confidence that they will ramp up to a level that is at least going to provide support for local efforts. But here in New York, and this is something I want to underscore for everyone on this call, it's going to be up to the local jurisdictions to help the Census Bureau by tailoring messages. In other words, what works in one place may not work in another, and we all have our unique characteristics, our unique demography, if you will. And that unique demography will require that we develop tailored efforts, and local support for those efforts is going to be, I think, key this time around. For example, here in New York City, we are currently putting together an outreach office, a director, and with a deputy. And we are going to have staff in each of the local area census offices. Now, if you remember from before when Terry M was talking, these are the offices out of which the census is actually executed. And having somebody on the ground to help them work closely with the Census Bureau and bring local knowledge to the process, and most important, asking or working with the Census Bureau to hire local people to work in those neighborhoods. I cannot underscore that enough, that we need to have people from the neighborhoods working in those neighborhoods, because this goes back to the trusted sources. If your next door neighbor is urging you to respond, or a local community leader that, again, is a trusted source, it could be in a church, it could be a community center, a person works in your local community center, a person who works in your local library. These are people who will provide you with the context, with the understanding that the census is safe, that Title 13 is the law of the land, and that you should respond to the census. So I cannot say enough about the fact that localities need to rise to the occasion. And they do that frequently by forming these complete count committees, which are groups of people that consist of trusted sources to underscore the importance of the census and how it is relevant to your day-to-day life. That is the other point. It must be personal, that in effect, you must communicate a message that says that if you don't answer the census, that you're going to be denied political representation, and potentially that community center that you're in might be in jeopardy. In other words, it needs to be brought home at a very local level, and I can't say that enough.
Shin, if I could add one thing quickly, Joe is absolutely right, everyone, about the need to tailor messaging and messages to, you know, a very diverse range of communities, geographically, culturally, linguistically, philosophically, et cetera. But there's a lot of common information that all communities will need to help support the Census Bureau's work. And so organizations like the Leadership Conference, which was in 2010 and probably will be in 2020, one of the leading national organizations to help make sort of the sort of commonly needed information about census operations, about hiring opportunities, about how the Bureau might count the homeless population, make that information available across the country in the form of fact sheets and briefings and the like. So you should keep an eye on sources like the Leadership Conference Education Fund, which will begin to start to bring those resources to bear on what these complete count committees are doing from the national perspective.
Thank you. And as a reminder, to ask a question today, please press the star and one on your touch-tone phone. We'll take our next question from Kevin Andrade with Providence Journal. Your line is open.
All right. It's Andrade, actually. So first thing, thank you for taking the time to speak with us. And also, Providence has been in the news lately in regards to having what has been called by the New York Times the only dry run in the country of the census. And there's a computer in a very immigrant-heavy neighborhood that's in a public library and where people can fill out the census, and it's only been used once. The Times story points to a lack of funding as the main issue for this, but I'd also like to point out that that is in one of these that is in a public library, one of these centers that people in the community tend to trust. And there are mumblings on the street that a lot of it has to do with fear of citizenship, in particular the citizenship question that is going to be coming up on the 2020 census. So I was wondering what is being done in order to alleviate fears along those lines that ICE might come to your door if you say, no, I am not a citizen of the country.
All right. So, Joe, I'm going to start at the high level in terms of the dress rehearsal site. It's called the 2018 end-to-end test, everyone. It used to be called a dress rehearsal. It is now going on, as our colleague pointed out, in Providence County, Rhode Island. The dress rehearsal is suffering from one of a number of glaring omissions. There wasn't enough money for the Census Bureau to do a partnership campaign and a communications and advertising campaign for the dress rehearsal. So that's possibly one reason why people, households may not be responding or may not have gone to the library. If you had a good advertising campaign, again, with trusted voices conveying the message that you can go to the library and it's a safe way, an easy way and quick way to respond, that might have been a different situation. So it's important to know that there was a lack of funding for a full dress rehearsal or dry run in that sense. Also, keep in mind that this dress rehearsal does not include the citizenship question. The decision to add that question was made not only well after the forms were, you know, designed and printed or put online for the dress rehearsal, but after the dress rehearsal had actually started. So it's important to understand that. Nevertheless, as you correctly point out, we think there is a climate of fear that even preceded the addition of a citizenship question. So, Joe, I'm going to turn it over to you from a perspective of the nation's largest city with, you know, a very large population, immigrant population and households that are multi-status. There are immigrants who are citizens, legal permanent residents, undocumented residents, people with uncertain status, all in the same household, and how that could affect participation in the census. Joe?
Yeah, we've put actually the number at over a million people in the city of New York. We have about 8.6 million persons in the city, and we put it over a million people who are sitting across the table from each other, one of whom is undocumented, but a child who's a citizen, an uncle who's a legal permanent resident, and a cousin, let's say, who's undocumented, sitting across the table from each other every night having dinner. And the thing they all have in common is they're all afraid. And we have been pursuing a message here in New York, which essentially says that we need to fill out the census honestly, that efforts that are out there right now, all kinds of ideas on how to game the system, they betray essentially the law of the land. The law of the land is that we have Title 13. Title 13 was passed in 1954. 63 years later, it essentially guarantees the confidentiality of census responses. Now, I ask an important, I think, a good question, which is if people choose not to respond or are told, frankly, not to respond to the citizenship question, then they are in effect saying that they do not trust the Census Bureau to abide by Title 13. And they are also asked on that same form to put their name and address down. So by pursuing this path of selectively answering questions or of choosing not to answer questions, in effect, what you're doing is you're undermining the confidence that is provided to us by law in the census. And we are trying to urge people to, trying to get people to understand that, to understand that we have those protections. But nonetheless, we acknowledge there is a lot of fear, and that fear can play out in very bad ways, costing the city political representation, costing it resources that we need. Ironically, the very people who may be most afraid are the people in need of those resources. And let me say one thing about Providence that's interesting. I was at a talk last week where a high-level person from the Census Bureau talked about the kiosks that were in the post offices. So might be an interesting thing to go and take a look at whether those kiosks in post offices are enjoying use. Also, there was talk about people who are responding via new ways. You know, obviously the internet factors in very highly in the Providence test. I believe that a very high percentage of the people who have responded in Providence are using the technology of the internet.
And Corelli and Shin, this is Terri Ann again. Let me just clarify. I think we may be getting a little technical here, so let's just clarify. Title 13 of the United States Code is otherwise known as the Census Act. Right? That covers everything the Census Bureau does, not just the decennial 10-year census. But what Joe is referring to is that within that Act within that part of the United States Code, which actually dates well back to the beginning of the 1900s, but has been amended, as Joe correctly pointed out, to make parts of it stronger. There is a very strict provision that says that any personal data you provide to the Census Bureau must remain confidential. And it may not be shared with any other government agency at any level of government, federal, state, local. It may not be shared with a court of law, any other entity outside of the Census Bureau. And furthermore, it's a separate section, none of the data the Census Bureau collects may be used to harm anyone. So if, therefore, an agency like ICE or Department of Homeland Security or any local law enforcement agency, let's say, cannot use information that the Census Bureau collects to, again, harm someone or their family from a legal standpoint. So just want to clarify what we're talking about when we say Title 13 protections. Let me add one thing. Census workers or anybody who works for the Census Bureau, either directly or indirectly as a contractor or liaison, is subject to very stiff criminal penalties for violating that confidentiality provision, and they are subject to that for life, up to $250,000 fine, up to 5 years in prison.
And let me add that the LUCA process that I described to you earlier, the files that are given to us of exact addresses from the Census Bureau are protected under Title 13. That data cannot be used for any purpose other than the review of addresses for the decennial census.
Thank you. And once again, if you'd like to ask a question today, please press the star and one on your touchtone phone. We'll go next to Art Raymond with Deseret News. Your line is open.
Good morning. Thank you, Terry and Joe. Thanks for your time and your insight. Super helpful. I'm wondering if you could just give us a sense, since you're both census veterans, about whether 2020 is shaping up to be maybe one of the most difficult or potentially least accurate efforts with what seems like kind of pyramiding challenges, the citizenship question, funding challenges. You know, some of the support information ahead of this call noted 50% fewer area census offices. Can you just give us your kind of your feeling about sort of our where we're headed with this particular effort, the 2020 census?
Well, Joe, I'll start. I'm going to keep this very brief because we are getting beyond nuts and bolts here, and that's okay. It's probably inevitable, so I'm just going to repeat something I have said on leadership conference press briefings in the past. I also direct you to statements that the leadership conference president herself has made, many of them including testimony before Congress last October and other statements more recently about the citizenship questions. Those are on their website. Let me just say this very quickly. I mean, I do not think we should put the cart before the horse, meaning I don't think we should say this is going to turn out to be the least accurate census in a long time. I don't want to go there. What I have said is I think that this census is facing an unprecedented confluence of factors that I think could create a perfect storm in 2020. So we do have the first high-tech census, and that technology is great, but that does bring with it cybersecurity risks, of course, and it also presents the problem of the digital divide. As you pointed out, there has been inadequate and delayed funding over the course of most of this census planning cycle. It's a 10-year cycle, and that has caused the Census Bureau to delay or cut back or even eliminate some really important research and testing opportunities. And now the Bureau is just running up against the clock. So it now has more money, but it's going to continue to need more money over the next 2 years, and it can't make up for lost time anymore. And then, as you said, there is both the climate of fear, which we talked about earlier, that predated the new citizenship question, just anti-immigrant in fear in many communities, but other communities just are skeptical of government. And those communities, too, will be difficult to count. And that, you know, spans the philosophical and political spectrum. And then finally, as you said, there is now a new untested question added to the form that has not gone through the rigorous multi-year iterative research and testing process, a question on citizenship asked of every household. And the implications, the consequences of that question for census response and then accuracy, as Joe described, are simply not known because it hasn't, that question has not been tested in a contemporary environment of this new redesigned census that we talked about.
I'm not sure I could add much to that, but I will make a couple of observations. One is that if you take a look in New York City and you look at what you would call self-response, I'm sorry, if you would call return rates, which Terri-Ann alluded to earlier, which is the kind of the best measure of initial compliance with the request to respond to the census. In other words, it has occupied housing units or households in the calculation. It's the final return rates. The neighborhoods with the best return rates in the city in 2010 were immigrant, non-English speaking, okay, and not very wealthy. They were Hispanic neighborhoods in the northern portion of Manhattan and one of the most diverse immigrant neighborhoods in Queens. And that's testimony to the importance of outreach and the importance of trusted sources in those communities and getting across the message. So it is very difficult to predict how these things will work out ultimately. In discussions I've had with a number of people who are very knowledgeable about census, they've gotten me thinking about something that is really quite interesting and in sync with a message coming from our own city hall. Our own city hall is trying to encourage people to become more civically involved. It's a democracy movement of sorts. People in their communities taking responsibility for what happens in their communities and becoming active participants. I have not heard, I have to tell you at this point, I have heard so much discussion about the decennial census that probably would have, I mean, I know these are threats and challenges we're facing, but people are talking about the census in ways, frankly, that are quite amazing. At this point in the process, it is late for all of us. We know that because of the we know what it takes to do a census. But from the standpoint of outreach, it is very interesting that we have discussions occurring among within neighborhoods that as a result of all the coverage of the decennial census. So that makes it even more difficult to try to figure out exactly how this whole thing is going to play, except that we know those challenges that Terri-Ann outlined are very big hurdles. But I just wanted to put that out there, as kind of a thought piece for what it is exactly that we're dealing with in the current environment.
Thank you. We'll take our next question today from Octavia Rainey with The Carolinian. Your line is open.
Thank you, and this will be our last question for today.
And Octavia, your line is open. Please check the mute function on your phone.
Can you hear me now?
Yes, we can.
Okay. I'm from Raleigh, North Carolina, and I have three questions I would like to ask. Number one, when you look at black neighborhoods across the United States, they have actually been displaced with the use of federal dollars that was actually from the census. So my question is, how do you encourage African Americans to actually support the census when they know that when this federal money come in, they will be forced out, priced out, and shut out? Number two, is there a plan to make sure that that black papers will have access to some of the funding to help educate in the black community the reasons why they should? Because when you look at this issue across the United States, black people are really being forced out of the black neighborhoods. So I think that issue must be addressed. The third question is this. I've worked on the 2010 census in Wake County, and I was the co-chair of the outreach. What we found out in Wake County is that in our jurisdictions, a lot of the towns of the city only invested X amount of funding in outreach. So a lot of that, we had volunteers who really went beyond the call of duty to make sure that we actually got all of our responses back in. So I'm just concerned about those three areas and how will the census be able to assure African Americans that by filling out this information, by filling out the census form and sharing your income, that you would not be priced out, forced out, or shut out in black neighborhoods, because that is the trend. So how do you plan to make sure that people understand this? Because there's a big fear, and I personally don't think that for the first time there would be a huge response in filling these forms out, because now you can actually see, feel, and touch. And so you have to ask the question, what was the benefit of me actually filling it out? I'm not receiving the dollars. That's a huge question. Now people are actually saying it.
Right. So I think it's a very important question, and I know we have limited time left, so I'll try to give you a short answer. First of all, I think all of us on the phone agree that this has to be a focus of the Census Bureau, right? And the stakeholder groups that we represent, whether it's cities and counties or advocacy organizations and community groups, you know, will be pressing the Census Bureau to address those concerns and will support efforts to do so. Let me clarify one thing. There is not a question on the census that everybody gets in 2020 about income. I just want to clarify that. Nevertheless, that doesn't undermine the importance and accuracy of what you said. This is why a very robust communications campaign and partnership effort that is targeted to different communities and meets the concerns and questions like the ones you raise at different communities is so important. The Census Bureau says it is planning a communications campaign with a big national advertiser and a lot of sub-advertisers of about $500 million. That's, you know, over from now through 2020. Stakeholder groups are urging the Congress to allocate even more money because, as you said, the communications real effort really needs to trickle down to the neighborhood, the local level. For example, black newspapers, very good example that people really trust. So we on the outside will be pressing the Census Bureau to spend its resources in that way and also to press Congress to allocate even more money given these growing challenges. And your final point about state and local dollars, you're right. I mean, the Census Bureau doesn't give state governments or local governments or even community groups direct money to supplement the Census Bureau's own outreach and promotion and advertising effort. It does a little bit of in-kind stuff, right? If a local group wants to host an event, the Bureau might pay to rent the VFW hall or the local hotel or maybe pay for some swag. But it doesn't do any direct grants. And so you're right, some states, some cities may be able to put more money into supplementing what the Census Bureau does than others. So I think that local leaders really have to press upon their state governments to ante up some money if they can.
Yeah, I think Terri-Ann just hit it. In New York, I can tell you that local communities need to, first off, encourage people to respond. And then having had a community that did respond, The dollars and the participation that come along with that, okay, that the local communities need to hold their elected officials accountable to them for the services and for the kinds of things that should come as a result of having a good enumeration. And that will only happen if people become civically involved. My solution for a lot of what you correctly mentioned earlier is civic involvement. If people become civically involved, then action will follow. Only if people become civically involved will action follow. If it's apathy we're dealing with, then you can bet that and it will not be a good outcome. And that's part of the difficulty that we're dealing with as we face these challenges with the census going forward.
Yeah, and Corelli, 30 seconds. I know you want to wrap up. If, in fact, there are communities that don't like the policies and programs that are affecting their communities, and that's understandable, then the one way to change that is to change the people who represent you in on the city council, the federal level, at the state legislative level. And the only way to make sure that you can elect the people who you think will represent you the best is to be counted in the census, so that when seats are apportioned for Congress and state legislatures, and then district lines are drawn at all levels of government, that those lines and that legislative jurisdictions are based on a fair and full and accurate count of everybody who lives there. So if you want to flip it around, that may be the way to think about it.
Thank you so much, Terri-Ann and Joseph. We really appreciate you jumping on this call with us. And so this concludes today's call. Thank you all for joining us today. In a follow-up email, I will include a recording of this call and new George Washington University research on the top 300 federal programs that rely on census-derived data. Once again, thank you for joining, and have a great afternoon.